Okay, this hour, let's take your phone calls, questions, stories, and so much more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Johann Harry with us, and his book is Lost Connections. Johann, what message would you like people to get when they read this incredible book?
For a really long time, we've acted like depression is a kind of pathology, right? That it's a sign that you're either crazy or you're biologically broken. And the core of what I learned from these amazing scientists all over the world is that if you're depressed and anxious, or if someone you love is depressed and anxious, that's not a sign of craziness. That's a sign that your deepest needs are not being met. It's now that biological factors like your genes that can make you more susceptible to that. But depression is overwhelmingly caused by these nine factors in the way we're living today that are not compatible with what human beings need to have a good life. Some of those factors were really challenging for me to learn about. So I'll give you one example. If I tell you how it was discovered, it might sound like I'm talking about something completely different, but bear with me because I think the story is really important. A guy called Dr. Vincent Felitti in San Diego made a really important discovery. So in the mid-1980s, he was asked by Kaiser Permanente, who were a not-for-profit medical provider, to try to figure out what was going on with obesity, because they had a hugely rise in obesity crisis, and they didn't know what was causing it, and they were, you know, so they just said to him, you go and do, like, blue skies research. So he starts working with severely obese people, I mean people who are more than 400 pounds, people who've tried everything. And one day he has this kind of, what seems like a really dumb idea. He just thought, if people just kind of stopped eating, if they just stopped and we gave them all the nutritional supplements they need and we monitored them, wouldn't they just lose loads of weight? So he decided to try it. They began it, obviously very closely medically supervised. And what they found was kind of incredible. It worked. People who'd been 400 pounds went down to being 138 pounds. But then something happened they hadn't anticipated. Loads of the people who lost, so I'll give you an example, one woman who I'll call Susan to protect her medical confidentiality,
sure,
went down from being 408 pounds to 138 pounds. And one day she freaked out and she went and she started compulsively eating again. She went back to a really extreme way.
What happened to her?
That was exactly what Dr. Felitti sat with her and tried to figure out. And it turned out something had happened that hadn't happened to her in a really long time. When she was really overweight, men didn't hit on her. But when she lost weight, suddenly one day a man hit on her and she absolutely freaked out.
She couldn't handle it.
So Vincent said to her, Vincent starts talking to her and he said to her, you know, Susan, when did you start to put on weight? It turned out when she was 11. He said, well, why when you were 11 and not when you were 9 or not when you were 14? What did anything happen when you were 11? And she said, well, that's when my grandfather began to rape me.
Oh, jeez.
It turned out 55% of the people in this study who were extremely obese had been sexually abused and had put on weight in the aftermath of their sexual abuse. So this thing that had seemed like a completely irrational pathology, being really obese, which is obviously dangerous, actually Vincent realized had a function. It was protecting them from sexual attention. As one patient said to him, overweight is overlooked, and that's what I need to be. So Vincent then wanted to expand this research, because this was quite a small group, it was about 350 people. So with the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, he did a massive study. Everyone who came to Kaiser Permanente in San Diego over the following year, whether it was for a broken leg, a headache, or, you know, schizophrenia, got given a questionnaire. And it asked them, did any of these 10 bad things happen to you as a kid? And then it asks, have you had any of these problems as an adult? So things like obesity, addiction, and one of them was depression. When the results came back, the CDC just could not believe it. What they found is that every category of childhood trauma you experienced, you were radically more likely to be depressed. You were 3,100% more likely, if you had a severely traumatic childhood, to attempt suicide as an adult. You were 4,600% more likely to be an adult injecting drug user. You don't get figures like that in science. It's extremely rare. What it showed, and this was, to be honest, this was really challenging for me. I didn't want to think about this. In my own life, when I was a child, my mother had been ill, my dad had been in another country, and I experienced some very extreme acts of violence from an adult in my life. And I think one of the reasons why I really clung to the kind of chemical imbalance theory about depression, that it's just a problem in your brain, is partly because I didn't want to think about the fact that those things had really harmed me. But what I found really encouraging and empowering was what the next stage of Dr. Felitti's research, on this study, when they, on the questionnaire, when they went to the doctor, that they'd had some childhood trauma, he got the doctors to just say to them next time they came in, just whenever they came in for medical care, I see that you marked on your form that this really terrible thing happened to you when you were a child. I'm really sorry that happened to you. That should never have happened. Would you like to talk about it? And some people didn't want to talk. Some people did. One old woman said, I'm so glad you asked. I thought I was going to die and no one would ever know. And what happened next was, to me, the most interesting thing. So the doctor would also say at the end, if you want to speak to a therapist about this, we can arrange it. There was a really significant fall in depression and anxiety just from the five-minute meeting where an authority figure said, that shouldn't have happened to you. And I think that's related to shame. We know, for example, that openly gay men died 2 years later than closeted gay men during the AIDS crisis, even when they got medical care at the same time. Shame kills you. It destroys you. Giving people a way to release their shame, which is one of the reasons why I decided to talk about some of the things that happened to me, even though it's very painful, is an extremely powerful and natural antidepressant. So I think that's an example. That's one of the more extreme examples of the nine causes of depression and anxiety I talk about in my book, Lost Connections. But I think, again, that shows. Imagine how disgusting it would be to go to Susan, that woman, who was raped by her grandfather, put on all this weight, was acutely depressed, and tell her, you know, your problem is just you've got a chemical imbalance in your brain and you only need to drug yourself, right? I think that would be a really ugly thing to say to her.
Yep.
And I learned about lots of antidepressants like this. So I'll give you another example that I think a lot of your listeners will identify with. There was this experiment in Canada in the 1970s. So what the Canadian government thought is that being financially insecure makes people feel really bad. So they did this experiment. They chose a town. They literally chose it at random. It's a town called Dauphin. For anyone who knows Canada, it's about 4 hours out of Winnipeg. It's in Manitoba. And they said to a load of people in this town, okay, from now on, we're going to give all you guys in monthly installments $17,000 a year as a guaranteed basic income. There's nothing you can do that means we'll take it away.
And it's free, all free.
I mean, yeah, we're literally not asking you anything in return. Exactly, it's free, right? Just because you're a citizen of our country and we want you to have a good life, right? It was a way of taking the money that used to be spent on welfare that was, you know, very hard to administer and just purposing it, right? And it was followed to see what would happen. So several things happened. People spent more time with their children. People studied more. More women went to work. People worked a little bit less. Almost nobody stopped working, virtually nobody. But some people did leave not very good jobs and hold out for better jobs, and that meant that work standards had to improve. But for me, the most important result is there was an enormous fall in depression and anxiety. Depression and anxiety that was so severe that people had to be hospitalized fell by 9%.
Jeez.
What that shows us is that if you're listening to this and you are financially insecure, and more than half of Americans don't have $500 in the bank for if a crisis comes along, you're not crazy to be depressed and anxious. That's absolutely terrible. You shouldn't have to live like this. In fact, there are ways we can live. A universal basic income, you know, people used to think it was crazy to have food stamps. Now very few Americans are opposed to food stamps. People used to say Medicare was crazy. Now Medicare is literally the most popular thing in the United States, apart from the military. So that's a change. Now, again, I would call that, and in fact, the main expert on that, a woman called Dr. Evelyn Forget, said to me, that's an antidepressant. But that's, to think about that, we have to communicate to depressed and anxious people in a different way. When I was a teenager, and I went to my doctor, and I was in such pain and distress, and I was told this is just a biological problem in your brain, actually, I realize now, although I'm sure my doctor meant well, that was actually quite a cruel thing to say, because firstly, it just tells you you're broken. The only solution is just you're going to have to endlessly drug yourself. And by the way, the drugs don't have, they have some effect, but not so much. They lift most people out of depression. But more importantly, it tells you that your pain doesn't make sense, that it's kind of a pathology. You know, to use a silly example, you know, I'm always surprised by when indigestion pills exist, right? Because whenever someone offers me an indigestion pill, I want to go, but wait a minute. Indigestion is a signal from your body that something's going wrong, right? You don't want to get rid of that signal because then you'll eat too much, you'll make yourself sick. You need to listen to it. In a similar way, now depression is unimaginably more painful than indigestion, but depression is actually a signal, a perfectly sensible signal that we evolved for a very good reason, that your life is not going how it should. And that's not to say it's on you to fix it, because actually, one of my closest relatives is, you know, a really struggling single mum who's fighting to pay the rent every week. The idea is saying to her, hey, your job now is to fight for a universal basic income and to democratize your workplace would be ridiculous. There are things in the book, in Lost Connections, that I go through that individuals can do. But a lot of these changes have to happen at a social level.
Sure.
We know this about most problems. We don't say that the solution to car accidents is for people who've already been mangled in car accidents to have to go and change everything. We have speed limits and seatbelts and airbags, and we have driving tests, and we arrest people for DUIs, right? In a similar way, we need the solution. I think part of the problem is that we've put the job of solving depression only on depressed people and their families and some psychiatrists. Actually, because depression isn't a technical problem, because it's a social and spiritual problem in the way we live, and that's not just me saying that, that's the World Health Organization, the leading medical institution in the world, that requires a different way of solving it. And it's worth remembering, the things that are making some people, like me in my past, depressed, are making almost everyone listening to this show unhappy, right? I would be surprised if there are many listeners who aren't affected by, you know, being controlled.
Well, I'm sure that everybody has had moments of depression or anxiety or something. Let's go to the calls now for you, Johan.
Sure.
Let's go to Joe, truck driving in Ohio. Welcome to the program, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi, Joe.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Great, Joe. Good. Thank you.
I've been on paroxetine for 30 years for panic attacks, and it all stemmed back when they sent me to the psychiatrist that I was molested when I was 5 years old by the babysitter. And when I told my mother of the incident, I got my bottom spanked good and proper.
Yeah, you were the guilty one, she probably said, right?
Yes. She says that you are more or less a damaged goods.
Jeez.
And that's what they come up with.
I'm so sorry. That breaks my heart. That should not have happened to you, and I'm really, really sorry that that happened to you.
How have the drugs worked for you, Joe?
I haven't had a panic attack in, oh my God, I'd say 29 years.
Wow. So it's working. You take it daily?
Yes, sir, I do. Go ahead.
I wanted to bring Johan in on this. Johan.
I'm just really moved by what you said, Joe, and I really admire your courage in talking about what happened to you, and I think you should be really proud of yourself. And I think exactly what you said about, you know, that you were shamed rather than loved for this terrible thing that happened to you. That's the kind of disaster that I think, you know, you're part of this wider picture that the science shows that causes depression and anxiety. Paroxetine is the drug I took, and there's lots of people like you who do have a benefit from it. For me, personally, I was part of a different group, and, you know, the science shows there's a really significant number of people like you who get a benefit from the drug. For me, the benefit was quite short-lived, and the side effects were quite extreme, so I put on a huge amount of weight. It's a difficult thing to talk about, but about 75% of men who take paroxetine and chemical antidepressants, SSRIs, antidepressants, experience some form of sexual dysfunction, which particularly makes me worry about teenagers who are given it, how that affects their sexual development. So for me, the side effects didn't ultimately outweigh the kind of very small and modest benefit, but the fact that it's giving you some relief, it really, I think, is fantastic. And I hope that you've been given kind of support to talk about what happened to you. And as I say, you should, far from being ashamed, you should be really proud of yourself for your courage in talking about it.
Yeah. At the time that I took the panic attack, I had a 4-year-old daughter and about, I'd say, 6-month-old son. And we had to get a babysitter because me and my wife both had to work, you know, in this day and age. And it put chills down my back that I was going to put my children in somebody else's hands and just worrying and wondering if that would happen to my kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you feel?
And what's so moving about that, Joe, as well, is that what was causing you panic was this incredibly positive emotion, which is love. And I think that's the most important thing for me for you to, I think, for you to hold on to in that story. You love your children, and it's because you love them that you were afraid. And again, that's not a pathology, right? You've been through this terrible thing, you'd survived, and that's hugely to your credit, and you've had children yourself, and you love them, and you want them to be safe. And I think telling you, oh, it's just a chemical imbalance in your brain, would actually be insulting to you. Now, there are biological aspects to depression and anxiety, of course, which I talk about in the book, but I think you're totally right, that the love that shows is as moving as the courage you've shown in talking about this.
Johann, is there a trigger for some of these events for people where it just happens, but there's some specific trigger that causes
totally.
Things?
So a lot of it would be what Joe was just talking about, what's called implicit memory. So you're in a situation that's a bit like something that happened before where you were hurt and wounded, and it just brings out that memory. And like Joe said so brilliantly, you just panic and you want to kind of, you know, you can't take it. So yeah, there are all sorts of triggers that are based in people's psychology, in the things they've been through. It would be kind of specific. So there are kind of deeper triggers, which are things like loneliness, if you find yourself alone, being controlled at work, and being cut off from the natural world, if you don't see the natural... So we all know that, for example, zoos, animals go crazy in zoos, right? They parrots will rip out their feathers, horses will start swaying compulsively, elephants will grind their tusks down to nothing, and that's because they've been deprived of their natural habitat. There's equally good evidence our natural habitat is to be in basically green space, and most of us don't live in green space anymore, and there's a lot of evidence that's causing depression and anxiety too. So actually just getting into the natural world when you can is a really powerful antidepressant as well. So I think there's a whole range of these triggers that I go through in Lost Connections, but I'm just really moved by what Joe said.
Let's go to Bill in Seattle, Washington before the break. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, it's, reason I called was I got a depression problem and anxiety, and I can't sleep. And it started when my wife passed away, and then I lost my house, and then I had to take care of my father-in-law. He was quite old, and I lost my dog.
Oh, geez, Bill. And do these things just come and go, or do they stay with you?
My wife stays with me. My dog, I know I can get it replaced, but I just haven't had the, I just haven't been able to do it.
Are you on medication, Bill?
No, I refuse medications for depression. I know what they do. I worked in a mental institution, and I know what they do to people. And I'll stay away from it.
All right, both of you, hold on. We're going to hit a break. But, Bill, I want to come back to you in just a moment here on Coast to Coast. And then, Johann, I want to get your reaction to that. The name of the book we're talking about is called Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions. We'll go back to your calls in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. So hang with us. Hey, our first luncheon series of the year is going to take place on February 13th here in Los Angeles. It's with Dr. Sky. It's selling very quickly. Send an email, lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com, and make arrangements to come by. lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. And welcome back with Johann Hari. Let's go back to Bill in Seattle, too. Bill, how often do these attacks come up on you?
About every night.
Every night. Okay.
Yeah, I can't sleep. I get up.
Do you feel like you can't breathe when you're in bed?
Sometimes.
So, Johann, what does he do?
Well, I think I just want to say, first of all, I'm really moved by your call, Bill, and what you said. And it made me think about this wider debate, and then I'll get to the specific thing about what I'd recommend Bill does. So in the 1970s, for the first time, American psychiatrists laid out a kind of checklist so that people could diagnose depression, right? And they discovered there's something really awkward and explosive. So they lay out this checklist, and it's pretty obvious things like, you know, it's 10 symptoms you can show, like, you know, feeling worthless, persistent low mood, that kind of thing. And they send it out to psychiatrists all over the US, and they say, if a patient shows more than 5 of these 10 symptoms for more than a few weeks, you should diagnose them as depressed. But so they start using these guidelines. But then in the years that followed, these psychiatrists came back and said, look, there's something really inconvenient here. If we use this checklist, every single grieving person should be diagnosed as depressed, because these are the symptoms of grief as well as depression. And this was really awkward. So the psychiatrist invented what they called the grief loophole, which basically said, you diagnose someone as depressed if they've got all these symptoms, unless they've lost someone they love in the last year, in which case it's a totally natural way to respond, right? But this begged, as they started using that, but this begged a different question, which was people started going, well, hang on a minute. Why is losing someone you love the only situation in which reacting this way is natural? Why not if you lose your house? Why not if you lose your job? Why not if you're trapped in a job you hate? There's a whole range of things. And this was such an inconvenient debate that they just got rid of the grief loophole. It doesn't exist anymore. So now, if your baby dies at 10 a.m., you can be diagnosed straight away with a mental illness, with depression. In fact, Dr. Joanne Cacciatore has shown that 32% of grieving parents are diagnosed in the first, are drugged in the first 48 hours after they lose their child. And when I spoke to Dr. Cacciatore, who's the expert on this, who lost her own baby, she said to me, it shows, and I thought about so much what Bill was speaking, it shows how we just don't get human suffering, right? We grieve because we've loved someone. We grieve, you know, if someone who lives across the street from me who I don't know dies, I don't grieve. I feel sad for their family. I don't grieve. We grieve for the people we love. Grief is a form of love. It's not a pathology. It's not a sickness. It's not something to be drugged away. In fact, if you drug it, Dr. Cacciatore argues you actually disrupt the grieving process. So the first thing I wanted to say to Bill is that your grief for your wife in particular is a tribute to how much you loved her, and you should be proud of that. It's a form of love. I wanted to say, in terms of the evidence about what helps with this form of grief, and I think depression more generally is a form of grief for your own life not going how it should. And the solutions to grief are a bit like the solutions to depression. So with grief, you know, you will never stop grieving. Last night I saw a friend of mine whose son died when he was a child 50 years ago. She still grieves for him, and she'll never stop it. She wouldn't want to stop.
You don't have to.
Stop right. Loving him. Sorry?
You don't have to stop, do you?
Exactly. But I think what will help, and there's good evidence for this, is if alongside that pain there are other things in your life. And by the way, you should be really proud of yourself that you also looked after your father-in-law, Bill. That's an amazing thing to have done. But I would say, if you can get into a mode, if you can start interacting with people socially, if there's anything in your neighborhood that you can start going to where you'll just get chatting to people, where you'll be among people, all the evidence about grief is it is worse if you are alone, just like depression is much worse if you are alone. And we're a very lonely and isolated culture. So I know that will seem difficult and daunting, but if you can get out to anything, if there's a Rotary Club, if there's anything in your neighborhood that you can go to and just be among other people, that in itself will be healing. It will never get rid of your grief, and you wouldn't want to get rid of your grief. But it will. The more you are in interaction, I mean, there's lots of other things I talk about in the book, but I think the one that would be most relevant to you is, along with some other things, is the more you can be among people, the more this pain will ease.
Johann, why do some panic attacks and anxiety attacks, they come in and they affect you, but then they go away? What makes them go away if you're not on medication or anything?
Yeah, we don't really know. So there's these 9 causes of depression and anxiety, which are, some of them are in our lives more than others. So, for example, we'll all have moments when we're more lonely than other moments. And these 9 causes of depression and anxiety that I talk about interact, right? So it may be that there's a day when you find your work more meaningful, when you're less lonely, when you went for a walk in the park. Because it's a complex thing, you don't want to give a... There's no simple answer to that, because...
Is it in the brain? Is that where all this is occurring?
Well, we're biological creatures, so absolutely everything about us happens in the brain at some level. But I think we've overstated the degree to which this is caused by problems in the brain. So your brain... Everyone knows about their body. It changes how you use it, right? I don't lift weights, so my arms are pretty kind of weak, right? If I started lifting weights, my arms would get bigger, which I'm not going to do. But in the same way, if you use your brain differently, your brain changes. So, for example, London taxi drivers have to do an extremely difficult test to get their license. It's called the knowledge. They have to memorize the map of London. It takes the average taxi driver 3 years to learn that. If you do a brain scan of London taxi drivers, it looks very different to how my brain or your brain would look.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. They've got the part of the, I think it's called, part of the hippocampus that relates to spatial awareness would be much bigger, just like your arms would get bigger if you lifted weights. That doesn't mean they've got a brain disease. And part of the problem is, often what some people will do crudely, not good scientists, but what some people will do crudely is they'll say, well, this is what the brain of a depressed person or an addicted person looks like, and look, it's different. That's true. Your brain is always changing throughout your life, so Bill's brain will look different to how it did when his wife was alive. That doesn't mean he's got a brain disease, right? And his brain will change again if he's able to socially reconnect, to reconnect with meaning and purpose, with the things, you know. And so your brain changes. So I think to say it's just in the, of course it's in the brain in the same way, you know, obesity is in the stomach, but it's also in KFC, right? Your brain changes. So the guy, Professor John Cacioppo at University of Chicago, says we shouldn't just talk about neuroscience, we should talk about social neuroscience. Your brain changes according to how you live.
Let's go next to Keith in Rochester, New York. Hi, Keith, go ahead.
Hey, Keith.
Yes, I'm going to buy at least 4 copies of your book, sir, and encourage others to buy.
Well, thank you, Keith.
In previous years, I've known some Amish and worked with Mennonites doing hard physical work. I have. You mentioned their group cohesion and that the group helped to downplay and keep at bay any depressions they might have. What I've noticed about them, and I have been around them, is that they are encouraged to be not part of this world that the rest of us have to be in, and that very insulation keeps down negativity that they would say that they are free from. I am the exact opposite. I'm going to just explain this quickly, and I mean it. I'm like a radio tower. I am a self-admitted news junkie. I take in everything like a vacuum. I guess you could say that if I allowed myself, I could be a depressed personality, but without bragging, I just refuse to succumb to any of that and just wish other people would have the inner strength that I know that I've built up over many years. I've never used drugs. I've never smoked. I've never been inebriated. I've even offered, and this is not a lie, I've even offered several times over the years to be even a human guinea pig in clinical research studies. I've said to people, if everyone were as drug-free as me, for all intents and purposes, you could shut down the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And I just wish other people could find that sucker in life, S-U-C-C-O-R, that sucker that keeps a person strong. And I'm sorry about Joe and Bill. I would just encourage them to reach deep inside themselves and find that strength. It is there. You don't need to say it's substance abuse. And I would just encourage people to dig deep, to engage in physical work when they can, and just to keep yourself going. I'm 62 and a half, and my final comment, I know that I could take to the ground half of the 30-year-olds I meet at least. 62 and a half, I could take to the ground guys that are half my age, and I would box them. And I would encourage people to be strong in life and just to keep at it and not give. And I want to say, it can be done. My mother was a suicide. I never will be. My mother took her life. I never will. So whatever is different from me than my mom, it goes on and on, and you just have to stay in there. And I would advise that to Joe and Bill. Man to man, I would.
Well said, Keith.
Thank you. Bye.
I love what you said there, Keith, about the Amish particularly. And I was really interested in this because there's this scientific evidence that the Amish have the lowest level of depression in the United States. And I was really puzzled by that, to be honest, because I grew up near an Orthodox Jewish community, and I always thought of them when I was a kid as like these weird throwbacks, right? Not secular Jewish people who were a lot of the people around me, but Orthodox Jews. I thought it was like you know, why would someone choose to live without electricity and, you know, to renounce all sorts of things? It just seemed so bizarre to me. And I went to spend this time with the Amish, who was kind of similar to Orthodox Jews in some ways. They give up a lot. And, you know, when I was there, I totally got it. Because one of them, I went to a place called Elkhart Lagrange, which is in Indiana, outside Fort Wayne. And, you know, speaking to the Amish there and spending time with them, you could see that they had something we don't have, right? So there's this interesting thing about the Amish, that when the Amish turn 16, they have to go and live in our world, right? They're forced to leave for 2 years. It's called going on Rumspringa. It's why no one counts the Amish as a cult, because no cult would say, just leave for 2 years and then come back, right? Decide whether you want to come back or not. And what's interesting, so they know how we live really well, and they talk about it really interestingly. One of them, Lauren Beachy, said to me, you know, there were loads of things I liked about living in your world. I liked that 70s show. I'd love to go driving across the country. But I realized if I choose those things, I'm choosing to not be present with the people around me. I wouldn't see my neighbors all the time. I wouldn't go to my church all the time. I wouldn't see my children the way I do. They, you know, lots of them said to me, I don't even understand how children get raised in your world because you're so cut off and isolated. How do you even do it? What they've got is a deep sense of togetherness and a deep sense of meaning. Now, there's plenty of things I don't like about the Amish as well. They treat gay people terribly. They have views about women that I think are awful. I'm not just waving the flag for the Amish here. But I do think they've got something that we have lost, and that we need to recover, and we've got a lot we can learn from them. And even just scientific things like, there's a very interesting thing called micro-awakenings. Basically, if you're depressed and anxious, you will wake up a lot in the night. And that's actually a very good way of measuring depression. And when they studied a group a bit like the Amish, they're called the Hutterites, they're even more hardcore than the Amish and giving up, they're totally off the grid. And they have no micro-awakenings, which is one way we know they genuinely are less depressed, anxious, and lonely.
Yeah, you tend to wake up early, don't you, when you're in that state?
Yeah. When I'm anxious, I wake up really early, and it's that horrible feeling where you can't get back. You're awake.
You can't go back to sleep. And then what do? You're up, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, it doesn't happen to everyone, but it's actually it's interesting. Sleep disruption is very common with depression, but it can go either way. Some people actually sleep all the time, you know, you actually end up sleeping like 12 or 13 hours, and some people have very disruptive sleep. With anxiety, it tends to be more, anxious people don't tend to sleep 12 or 13 hours a day. That tends to be more towards, you know, just waking up in the night and that kind of horrible anxiety. I just wanted to say about Keith as well, I was so moved by how he talked about his mother and what he went through.
Yes.
Because that must have been devastating, and he should be really proud of himself, and I suspect his mother would be really proud of him that he was able to make such a strong and powerful and admirable life out of
it. Johann, a minute left by the volume of calls here. We could have gone on for the next 10 hours. I can't get to anybody's calls because we're almost out of time. But I do want you to mention your website and the book where it's available, and the old one too, Chasing the Scream.
So anyone who wants more information about the book can go to www.thelostconnections.com. You can take a quiz to see how much you know about the real causes of depression and anxiety. You can listen to the audio of loads of the people we talked about. You can hear what people like Elton John and Glenn Greenwald have said about the book. You can also go to the book's Facebook page, www.facebook.com/thelostconnections. I always forget what the other things I meant to say at this point. For the previous book, which is about addiction, what really causes addiction, the book's website is www.chasingthescream.com. That's scream as in, like Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween. You can follow me on Twitter. It's JohannHarri101. And, yeah, I think that's my moment. I got asked an interview recently.
Super. Johann, thank you so much, Johann, for being on the program again. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.